This is our family. As you know by now, I'm married to the Queen. She's there in the middle holding one of our granddaughters. We just got news, of course, that we have a third grandchild, boy from India. So they have three now. My oldest daughter's on the left, married to Brad Martin, her husband. And then Landon's a little boy down there. And then this is our daughter's wedding, Kaveri. So that's Kaveri and her new husband, Westgood. And then that's my baby next. She's 18 years old, Christy. And then Tyler, he's dating, but she's not on there. But that's also Trevor. And we got, Trevor was a gift from Guatemala. So with getting more and more Indians in our family, we decided to start a dating service. And we're calling it Connecting the Dots. That was a bad joke. All right. So anyway, my little story I'm going to say is from goats to grandkids. And Willie gave me Willie gave me that idea because anyway. But I was born and raised in Hagerstown, Maryland. Does any of you know who Washington County, Franklin County Conservative Mennonites are? Oh, okay, a few of you. So that's the way I was raised. I'm a recovering Washco. So I was raised in a family of six boys and two girls.
Recovering what?
Washco, Washington County. That's what they call them now, Washco. Some of you may are old enough maybe to know that we are called Reubenites. And the reason why we are called Reubenites is we had one bishop over the whole church. His name was Reuben. Anyway, but then it went, then I guess he passed away, and then there were several bishops and so on and so forth. I won't tell you the history of the area. It was very conservative. I would have called it Orthodox Mennonite. Some of you, if you would go there, would kind of think it's kind of like Horning, but it actually is not Horning. Their ideology is a little different. But one thing I've learned everywhere I went, and I've been to several different places, I'm kind of nomadical, but is that there's good people everywhere you go. Everywhere you go, there's good people. And for me to stand up here and tell you all the faults of the places I went would be a reflection on me and not them. So I learned a tremendous amount in the growing up in that church setting. My mom was from Harrisonburg, Virginia. She was a Heat Wool. If you ever read the book called Vera's Journey, that's my grandma. Actually, there's a little clip in there about me. Making apple butter in a can, but so that's as far as I got in the news. That was a big family, 15 children. So one of the interesting things is the more conservative a culture is, the higher the cost of entry. So the more conservative you are, the more people have to give up, and the more unlikely the chance of evangelism really goes down as far as evangelizing to your culture. Not that the culture is wrong. So anyway, that was interesting because I grew up with this kind of a, you know, mom from Harrisonburg, Southeastern Conference, and my dad grew up there, and so I kind of grew up with this little bit of a split culture as a child, and. Anyway, that was primarily a dairy community, and so if you weren't in a dairy, they kind of looked at you as you didn't know how to work. So like, my dad had a furniture store, and so we would go and work in this furniture store. But in the classroom, we always had this kind of, you know, the wristers don't have to work for a living type of thing. But as a child, my drive to be accepted was pretty high, all right, and my being accepted by people was kind of on high alert. Some of that probably comes because of my relationship with my dad. I was the middle of the family and kind of just interesting. I mean, I was probably, yeah, to my shame, I was probably the biggest embarrassment to my dad, and you could probably understand that. But the other thing, because he was more like a perfectionist, you know, and if you'd have saw me in church, it was all these little six boys dressed to the T, right, type of thing, and except the one. Something looked funny with him. He was a little disruptive. But all that said, the, my craving to be accepted did get me into a lot of trouble. But there was this thing where I actually had a loyalty. One thing I want to tell you as dads is don't underestimate the power you have in your children's life for influence. And, you know, as dads, we have an unfair advantage when it comes to our children. And God created it that way, but our desire, our children's desire to get our approval is just amazing. And it humbles me, okay? Because, you know, I don't really feel like I deserve my children's appreciation. So, you know, one thing that drove me was I wanted to fit in. So since it was, you know, my dad was a furniture store guy, and I knew people looked at my dad the way he did, and a lot of other dynamics, and he married this woman outside the culture, and, you know, so she didn't really acclimate that great. So it created this unhealthy tension in my life. And that unhealthy tension led to a lot of rebellion, maybe not outward and sometimes, but a lot of inward rebellion. And the other thing that kind of came out of that is I wanted to get acceptance of the community. So I worked at a very young age. I started at 14. I started walking from school to work as a dairy hand because I wanted to identify as a dairy, you know, I knew how to work type of thing. And then I went to a couple different dairy hands when I was 14, 15, 16, I guess. When I was 16, I decided I wanted to do something different. And by the way, that's kind of been the story of my life, doing something different. So I decided I was going to, you know, I wanted to fit in this dairy community. So I started thinking I'm going to milk goats. And so at 16, I bought my first goats, and I started milking goats, and I had, I'll tell you a bad Mennonite joke. I had 300 kids before I was married. So I had this goat dairy, and this goat dairy actually took me to a point. I'd get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'd work till, you know, 10 o'clock at night. It was absolutely crazy. I actually hauled my milk for 3 hours to a goat milk processing plant. This was back before goats' genetics were at the point they are now where they actually produce. But and a lot more goat products are on the market now than they were back then. But you couldn't make a living milking goats, to be honest with you, because I had two jobs the whole time I did it. That was a story just to give you a foundation of who I am as a person, maybe in some sense, but also to give you a little bit of foundation of some of the things that that formed me as a person. And you know, I look back on my life, and I actually am not resentful about my life. I actually see my life as forming me and making me who I am today, even though I'm not proud of a lot of the decisions I made. And I'm very disappointed in some of the things I did. It's still the pain in my life is my great what brought me to a point where I'm at today. And I really feel like it put me in a place that I can help more people. And if I was to sum it up, I'd sum it up this way, and you'll hear it again. But I believe that we discover our created purpose in our pain. And when we are willing to steward our pain for other people's healing, we heal in direct proportion. And we all have pain. I believe that we discover our created purpose in our pain. And when we steward our pain for other people's healing, we heal in direct proportion to our willingness to be able to steward that pain. And I'll talk a little more about that later. And so just to bring my story a little bit full circle, then from there, I helped my dad. Remember, I had two jobs. So I'd help my dad, and he actually sold the dairy farm in an effort to try to kind of recapture the hearts of his boys. But the problem is we already had a taste of business. And to take you know, to take boys that are already learning how to make money in a business world and try to put them back on the farm, that was kind of interesting. I did put a little bit of farming in us, you know, like I still have a few sheep, and you know, he had sheep and hay and corn, and that's what that was our farming experience. The interesting thing is my dad didn't farm for money; he farmed with money. So we wound up, you know, doing things like waxing the baler and things like that that just were a little bit hard for us to accept because we knew nobody else was waxing their balers, right? You know, I guess the good news was he sold the baler for more than what he paid for at the sale, right? But, you know, we were like, this is nuts, man. Anyway, he was a perfectionist, so, and I'm not a perfectionist. And he would make furniture, we called it, for the sheep. You know, the guy was a craftsman. It was unbelievable. He could make furniture and stuff. Still living, 84 years old. All right. I got to keep my thoughts together. But back to the goat dairy. The goats are actually what got me to Lebanon, Pennsylvania, where I live now. And I was helping my dad haul hay to the Lancaster markets, and I look back on my life and I see everything. I believe God allows every person and every event in your life for a reason and a season, and we're just stewards of the reasons and the seasons. So the goats got me to Lebanon, and then my wife got my goat. Now, so the what happened was we went to this guy that I was delivering this hay to, and he asked me about me, what am I doing, and that kind of thing, and I said I was milking goats. He said, well, right over the hill is a goat dairy. You ought to go see him. So we went across the hill and went to this goat dairy, and this guy was a funny thing, but he was like overwhelmed with trying to do this. He had to keep two jobs. By now I should have figured this out, but he was running two jobs too. He was driving truck and processing goat milk and selling it in a little refrigerator in the back of his pickup truck to stores, health food stores. And well, you know what? We need help here. Would you be interested in bringing your goat dairy up? So I moved all my 300 plus goats up there, and well, it wasn't long until I realized this is a losing battle. Number one is he was going to an Eastern church that I was at that point, that I went to after I went to that area. Of course, I sought out a church, which was kind of backwards, okay? But it goes to show the disconnectedness between me and my dad. Whereas I kind of was like independent and self-governant. You know, I was living in a 10-foot by 10-foot, one of those little round rector-looking trailers now. At 16, I was living in one of those trailers. I mean, I about froze to death in winter. I put tarps over it. I put straw bales around it. But anyway, so that's the way I was living. But I'd go home on weekends. My mom could cook to kill, so I had to go at least get one good meal a day. Other than that, it was a little bit sketchy. It gets worse. So that was that, and then so I started my that's when I found a pastor that really cared about me. His name was Harry Erb, if any of you know him. Was down in Texas, and he used to take me and sit down with me, and just we'd talk about life. And that was the first time someone in leadership authority really showed me interest, and that's what won my heart toward leadership and started me on my journey of recovery to start valuing the spiritual authority in my life. So now one thing you'll find about some people is if they were dysfunctional in one area in their life, then they kind of focus on that the rest of their life, and God opens up opportunities that they have to reinforce that belief. And that's exactly what happened for me. So the Eastern Church went through a situation where they split, and then they had Northeast and all this kind of stuff. I'm not going to go through all the church history, but that was very disruptive for me. I finally thought I had a church that I could kind of, at the first church, that was Elm Street, a little church there, and it's City Church. We would go out and do street work every Saturday. That was all fulfilling for me. But when the church split and things changed and Harry moved to Texas and some things like that, the dynamic of the church started shifting. The focus of the church started shifting. We were entering a more of a wealthy society type of thing, and it was distracting the church away from all these things that these older men had started. And it started losing, you know, it was that me and two pastors were the only ones who showed up on a Saturday to go out and visit people. One problem I had, and it started back when I was a young boy. I would call a spade at any cost, and it got me in trouble a lot. I would tell people what they were thinking, and most people don't want you to tell them what you're thinking. And when I was in instruction class, I don't even remember, but it was over a year that I was in instruction class, and that really messed with me as someone that gave my heart to the Lord. And then to have someone question it and continue to question it, only to find out later, many years later, that it was a way for the church leaders to get to my dad and to deal with him, is to deal with him by through me. And it was a kind of a dark time in my life. So I'll just mention this just kind of in passing, but it's actually the reason what I'm doing today. And it's actually what gave me a clear picture of what I was going to do the rest of my life. I was in a one-third partnership with my dad-in-law and my brother, and it got to a point where I was willing, which is a God thing, brought me to a point that the relational pain was so great that I didn't really want to live anymore. And so I wasn't suicidal, I just did not want, I was not enjoying life. And did you guys ever hear that duck story about that duck ventriloquist where a duck's flying over and, you know, after a while everybody gets their bazooka guns out and they blow his feathers off and the duck's still quack, quack. Ever hear that story? Yeah, I might date myself. Anyway, that was me. I mean, they blew all my feathers off and I was still quacking. But there was a point where the quack left. Okay, so the quack left. Okay. That was a turning point in my life relationally, because at that point I woke up and said, you know what, life is a reflection. And the only one that's going to change it's me. And I had to come to grips with the fact that it's my choice if I'm going to change this. It's not theirs. And so I had to quit blaming other people in my life. At that point I held my dad hostage for the relational pain I was feeling in my life, and also held him hostage for how I was feeling. Or my mistakes and things like that. And that was a turning point for me. And so going through that issue basically brought me a point. I went to my brother, my dad-in-law, and just told them they can have the business. I'm walking away. I don't need anything. I want my relationship with them is more important than the money. And I would say that was the turning point of my life. You know, it was... The relational pain, I realized, is what triggered depression for me. And when the relational pain got that great, I just didn't want to live. Because in a lot of ways, I'll trade money for relationship, which is kind of frustrating if you're a spouse. Just trying to condense this, because I want to go into Willie's part here now. That led us to the journey, the charity journey. When right before the Eastern and the Northeastern split was, I kind of got to the point where saturation point, where I didn't really want to go through that again. And we had, at that point, we became good friends with Dean Taylor's because they were sending their children to our school. And so I got to be a good friend with Dean and Rex Blevins, if you guys know him. And these men were very instrumental in me transitioning without... going bad directions. And I was also at a time where I was actually really wondering if I was an Anabaptist anymore. I was just kind of got tired of it. And it was the leadership's inability to lead in a way that was effective and brought their people together. And probably what came out of that for me is I don't think it became very clear to me that I'll never be a very good conference Christian. I don't know if you know what that means, but I just don't work well at a conference setting. I would rather a small city church, dysfunctional city church, personally, where everybody was trying to love the Lord, you know? But God had other plans for me, and so I'm still in Lebanon, full of baloney, but still in Lebanon. And we go to a church called Joy Christian Fellowship. I love those people dearly. We have about seven different people groups. We have a few Amish. We did have a Catholic. We had some city people from Lancaster. We have Mennonites. We have Hutterites. Maybe a few Hittites and Parasites. I'm not sure. But it's really interesting. To make that kind of a church work, you have to be intentional. Because everybody, that means everybody, that we have all those different filters where everybody comes to a decision differently. So you have to be very, it takes time. And you've got to take the time to allow everybody to process church issues if you want to come out at a healthy place. And it takes strong leadership. If you don't believe me, ask Freeman. It takes, in some ways, it takes stronger leadership than when everything is black and white and spelled out. I will tell you this. These kind of environments are like milk. And in a conference setting, it's kind of like pasteurized milk. I mean, it looks beautiful. And it lasts for a long time. It's awesome. You know? But these kind of settings are like fresh milk. It really can be really good, or it can spoil really fast. It can have great food value, or it can spoil really fast. And I think we need to be aware of that and talk about that. You know, are we in a healthy place? Are we drinkable, or aren't we? You know, I think I might just open it up here if you have any questions, because I don't always know if I deliver my message well. I kind of speak in riddles and stuff. So one thing, that journey of church did give me clarification, a lot of clarification on who I was as a spiritual person. I've always struggled with my relationship with God as my father, because I think because of my challenging relationship with my dad, I've grown up in a performance culture, so usually the more conservative a church is, the more emphasis they have on performance. You know, if you do it right, you are right type of thing. So the less you have to define yourself in a way, but it's actually not true. You still have to define yourself. But that performance culture to try to get approval from my community and trying to get approval from my dad, drove me to not have a warped concept of who God was, and it's been a journey for me. So I told you where we are today, Joy Christian Fellowship. I would just put this out there. I think we've come to a place with these independent churches that I think we've finally come full circle now again, and we realize we actually need other people outside of our churches. And that's where Joy is right now. We're really thinking about what churches that we could align ourselves with to share best practices, you know, between leadership, what working, what's not, and hold each other's hands up in battle. And I think as time comes to an end, we're going to realize the need of that more and more. You know, we can come in here and have meetings for a weekend and leave, but there's something about if we carry your hearts with us and we, you know, we learn to know your stories and we care for each other and we want, you know, we can find some kind of commonality where we can support each other and cheer each other on. Something that's been very helpful for me is I try to identify three old men that I respect and meet with them 1 hour every month. And oftentimes they're from different churches and different things. And, you know, what that's done in my life has been is kind of priceless. It's been a lot to me. Actually, whether Freeman knows it or not, he's been one of those men unofficially. It's just refreshing to be able to process life with men that at least try to understand you. So, do you have any questions for me? My story is really a lot of stuff, but no question's a bad one, so.
Finding your life purpose and being a steward of the pain you've been through, how would you describe that in a nutshell?
I think I had to come to grips with the fact that God's allowing this pain in my life for a reason. And when I got to that point, And I started looking at life and realizing life's a reflection, and I take 100% responsibility for everything that's happening in my life. That's when I started to heal. And when I really took that to the next level is when I used that pain and started reaching out to people that I saw were going through the same kind of pain and started speaking into their life, encouraging them. So I didn't tell you this, but this brings up a thing. It'll explain something. And it's kind of a turn when I had that turning point. I really didn't want to live anymore, so I decided I want to make other people want to live. You know, so I decided I was going to write a note of encouragement every day to someone. Well, this is what I'm going to tell you. When you do your part, God does His. And at that point in my life, I didn't really feel like I had the Holy Spirit in my life. I really didn't. I just didn't hear, I didn't think I heard from Him. But I will tell you this, it almost gives me chills today, but God gave me a different person every day that year. That means 365 people got a word of encouragement from me. And I try to do that continue today, but that was confirmation that the Holy Spirit was giving me those names. And I'd wake up every day, and through that day, I'd think of who that person was. And so that was my way of using my pain for other people's healing. And it could have been somebody I was talking to on the phone at work. All of a sudden, the Holy Spirit, I need to follow this conversation up with a note of encouragement. And at some point, I realized that cards were very expensive. And so I started getting creative. But and then God showed up with this book distributor guy. I ran into him that was discouraged. And he showed me how to buy books at cheaper than you can buy cards. And then I found my books at Goodwill. All right. You know, I'd sign it, make a message, sign it and date it and give it to a person because I thought, you know what, he might pass it on to somebody else. Go into Goodwill and there's some of my books. Okay. Cast your bread on the water. Did I answer your question? I'll give you a little bit more of that in my last session. All right, any other questions?
So in all the different cultures and things that you've gone through, how have you been able to keep your children with you, keep your children's hearts, and also help them understand how to process, you know, conservative Anabaptism and the relationships with those type of people, charity and the relationships with those types of people, and continue on in a sustainable way? Or I guess maybe you don't know where your children's hearts are in relating to Christianity at large, but helping them have an appreciation for the Anabaptist culture with all of its dysfunction and sometimes negative connotation.
Yeah, that's a really good question. First of all, I'd recommend you to marry a good woman. I would really tell you that I don't feel like I did a disfavor to my children by what we did. I think it would have been a liability if I didn't have the conversation with them. So because we left the conservative church, we had conversations we would have never had. All right? But the point is are you willing to have those conversations? And the other part is, if you don't have the hearts of your children, you're done. You're going to lose them. All right? And you know that age between 14 and 20? You know it. That's when you're trying to really get your identity spiritually. And it's the peer pressure is off the charts, okay? You know the casualties with charity. I mean, while their parents were barking on the front porch, the children were playing hooky in the back porch, right? I mean, so there's a lot of dysfunction there, and if you're not intentional, to keep the hearts of your children through a journey like this? Ain't going to happen. So that's one part of it. But man, there's a lot of layers to that. The other thing is respect for authority. You know, I tried to drill it in my children to the point that you almost like got tired of, oh yeah, the authority, right? Okay. So I tried as much as I could to drill in that. I don't care how dysfunctional the authority. And I was telling Freeman this afternoon. I just told him, I said, you know what? The one story that still gives me chills today is David and Goliath, David and Saul. And the story is cutting the hem off of a garment of a man that's going to kill you. That is probably the most unbelievable story about authority I can tell you. You know, and then for him to repent of that. I think back about all the times in my life where I would have just liked to lynch the guy, you know? And I think, wow. So if you don't teach your children anything else, please just teach them how to come under authority. I don't know of any other gift you can give them that's going to be greater and serve them for the rest of their life. I don't think the choices we make are as impactful as the conversations we don't have. I took my daughter down to meet a guy that I want to tell you two parts of this story because both of them are important. Yeah, any of you guys ever hear of CRU, Christian Crusade for Christ? No, it's like a college ministry where it's been around for years. It started out by a very interesting guy that was very committed. I'm losing names right now. But anyway, what was interesting, I went down to him to ask him questions. So one of the things that, one of my hobbies is going, seeking out successful leaders and asking questions. So I went down with him, I took my daughter along with him, and I had to go to the restroom, and so I wasn't surprised he was going to ask Driller with questions because he's not real familiar with Mennonites. So I came back and overheard him talking to her, and I kind of backed up because I wanted to hear what she was going to say. And he asked him, what about your father has made the biggest impact on your life? I say this with humility because I don't deserve it. But this is what she said, and it really jarred me. She said, my dad is willing to tell us his mistakes so we don't repeat them. And I think it's how you tell them about your mistakes. Because my children are going to go way beyond me. They are going to go way beyond me. But the only way they can go beyond you is if you let it go. And this is where we had a generation that couldn't let go. So they could never go beyond us. You will limit a generation. Every generation must die for the next to live. Freeman's just about ready to die. He is. You guys have a choice. You can preserve the burger or let him die. How many of you guys are 40 years old and older? 40? Oh, you're older. Sorry. 40 years old and younger. Sorry. 40 years old and younger.
Oh, sorry. Why don't we understand that?
I'm going to send you, how many, you give me the number later, and I want to send you as many books as those guys that you have here. Okay, it's the book's called 40 by 40. I wish I'd have read it when I was 40, but I'll talk to you a little more about being 40. Do you have a Harley? No.
Yeah.
Any other questions? All right. Willie, you're next.
I don't think so. I think you're next.
You want to do the last session?
I think you should go. I'm going to just include something here, and then I think you should just keep going because time is moving on. There's not a lot.
You're hungry. Is that what it is?
I think it's good. You've got something going here. So we think it's important. See, they're starting to open up here. We're just having this discussion. They're not listening.
Oh, okay.
I think you were saying something.
Okay.
I think it'd be good to just do that.
He's my senior. I would tell him to stuff it. But all right. Well, I will if you want me to. But will you promise to close then?
Yeah.
All right.
I can at least pray.
That's a cop out. Did you ever hear that? You know, we'll pray about it. Come on, Willie.
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Okay.
You know, you talked about authority. I'd like to just say this, and where I'm at in my age here, I shared a lot of my experiences. There have been a lot of mistakes made. But I think the passion, what I had, is when I look at you young men and where you're at, you don't have to repeat these mistakes. Okay? I mean, you will make mistakes. But it really comes down to hard issues, and that's why Lyndon was saying authority. Mm-hmm. It's one of the most difficult things to deal with. But I think if you look at the Old Testament, you look at the Scripture, and God dealt with issues of authority almost with more wrath than he did with some of any other sin. That's rather significant. And the challenge is how can we have a healthy authority? And then you say, well, look at how my authority is treating me. Look what David responded to a man who wanted to kill him. Look at what Peter said. Pray for your authorities. Pray for the king. You know what that king wanted to do with them? Kill him. But I think God places us in authority because he wants to bring a brokenness in our hearts. Not, you don't have leadership here because they want to control you. I hope not. But they have a passion. They mean what is best for you. And that's where it's important in that kind of a setting. So we're not here. We're not getting paid by Freeman to say this. But
Maybe we are.
Maybe. Oh, I don't know what's going on here. I'd like to encourage you young men, all of you, to consider this in your hearts with where you're dealing with. Because you run from this situation and you jump into this situation, and all of a sudden somehow that person you ran from, you sort of have the same kind of a person to deal with, plus it's ratcheted up a little more. Amen. And then you jump to another person and you keep repeating the same things. And after you do the same thing three times, the only difference, the only constant in that variable is you. Because you change and change and change and keep having the same issues. And God is trying to speak to you. And he speaks through authority. He speaks through those people. And we're all human. We make the mistakes, but there is that God honors that. That's why you as fathers have authority over your children. And you want your children to hear you. Make sure you're listening to your authority. I'm saying that in kindness and hopefully in brokenness, because that really is an important thing. And I'm going to say this in a practical way. Be careful of your attitude toward authority. Be careful of the comments you make. And if you have a problem with your authority, make sure that you and your wife are discussing that in your bedroom. That's why you have a bedroom. Not at the kitchen table. You don't have fried preacher. I can tell you something of how a family devastated their children because of roasting the ministers and the leadership that we're having problems with. It's deadly. And I just want to encourage you guys. I'm not here beating you up. I hope that's not what's coming through here. But these are the things that are non-negotiables. These are these principles that are that it's a firm, fixed, eternal value that needs to be in our lives. And so I want to encourage you with that. As you say, well, how do you work with this? Do you ask that question? And I guess I volunteered to say that to you, but please consider that as you walk together. It's a beautiful thing when God can take all these differences and make one new man and demonstrate that to the world. go ahead and why don't you finish and then why don't you wrap it up?
Yeah, I'll just add to that that there is something that changes if you keep going, and that is your children no longer believe in any system.
That's right.
Your children no longer believe in any system. You raise up a children that can't trust any authority. And that's what we have in our country today. We have a country that's led by men that get in office because of how much wealth they have and how much they curse the man before them. And there's no blessing in that. God is removing his blessing from America. I'm not a politician. And I didn't vote for Trump. In fact, I don't vote. All right. Well, if you want to put my slides up, I will go through. I will go into this. So I think I mentioned this to you before. I think I'm going to have him click through it if it don't work. So I'll try it. I think I mentioned this to you before. You need the password? 5/31/1965. Now you know when I'm born. 5/31/1965. Okay, go down to the here. Right here. This button. Yep, click that. Now go up and click. Oh, click this one first. I just want to show you this. Right up here, it says old and new. All right, this is back when I wanted to show this to the children. And then you get over here to slideshow. I wanted to show this to the children. This is my children's lesson. I wanted to show you what it looked like back when I was a child. So you want to go to the next slide? That's the way it looks now. All right, you want to click the next? That's what it looked like when I was a child. All right, you want to click the other one? You want to click the next one? That's the way it is now. Okay, AI picture. Click it again. That's the way it did in the winter time look like for me. All right. Click it again. See, that's the way it looked like when we go out to eat now. Okay. That was actually a diner back then. Click it again. That's the way it looks now. I mean. Or did back then. All right, I think that's it. There might be another one, but I just thought, oh, yeah, that's the new childhood. One more. That's it, okay. Jump out of that. That was a distraction. I just thought that was good. Now, if you click up here, it says law of acceleration. You see that? All right, I run the risk here of... I have these three questions I want to leave with you. Is that the first slide? Is that? Yeah, you're at the end, I think. Start at the beginning, maybe it says. So I call this the law of acceleration. And the reason why, and I give this presentation, I'll alter it a little bit to a church setting here a little bit, but I give this this in business, and I guess I feel like that whether you're working in your home or your business or your church, you're dealing with people in every area. And okay, you can go to the next. You're dealing with people in every area, and I just want to ask you these three questions at the beginning and also the end. So these are my three questions: how will you steward your present, the people, and the pain in your life to invest in the people you serve this year? So all of you are serving people. And my question is, how are you going to invest? How are you going to steward the present, what you're experiencing right now, the people in your life, and the pain in your life for other people? And then the next question I have is, what are the three declarations you're going to make and nail them to the wall for everyone to see in 2024, because that's the only thing that you're really going to accomplish. The other things you might say you can, but you can also, I think it's very easy for us to make a declaration like losing weight. And, you know, if we don't make a declaration and declare it, other people don't see it, and so we can lose our incentive in it. But, and then what also, what are you going to do in 2024 to make God smile? So, I coach, do executive coaching, leadership, that type of thing. And my little tagline is, I inspire leaders to discover their creative purpose to make God smile. So that's where the God smile thing comes in here. I believe when we live in our creative purpose, God smiles, your wife smiles, your children smile, and everybody around you smiles. So I believe everything in life is stewardship. Everything. Even your pain. So our fulfillment in life is going to come from our ability to steward every aspect of our life. So I think the way we discover our creative purpose is by facing the current reality. And when I faced my current reality in my life is when I realized that life is a reflection. What I was experiencing was because of what I was doing and not what other people were doing. And until I took 100% responsibility in my life, nothing would change. It would just take different phases or different faces. So if you jump from one church to the next, you've heard this, you take yourself with you. It's just a matter of time till you'll discover that you're still yourself until you're willing to change yourself. And I think one thing definition we have of that is brokenness. The next thing I've found is when you define something, bring definition to it in your life, and you're willing to declare it, something will change. Until you're willing to declare it, very little changes. The other thing is, I won't take the time, but there's a lot of Bible verses that will validate this about God says he wants men to plan. You know, plan to build the city. You know, you're foolish if you don't plan before you build the city. You know, you plan and I'll decide if I'm going to prosper. But you're still supposed to do your part. You're supposed to plan. What I find is a lot of people don't make a plan. I would encourage you that if you come up against the wall, you have a problem at church, whatever. Okay, what's our plan? What's the first thing we're going to do? What's our desired outcome? And then backfill from your desired outcome. That's where you got to start. If you don't share the same desired outcome, it ain't going to work. So you first have to decide on what the desired outcome is. If that desired outcome is that you guys all want to be self-governed, great. You're a great evangelical church. That's exactly what they do, right? You guys come on Sunday morning, get a pep talk, go do what you want to do. But don't say you're Anabaptist, because you're just mocking. All right? So make a plan, and I will tell you that if you want to plan, the further out you plan, the sooner you get there. And I know that's like seems weird, but I can give you some illustrations of that. And the reason why is because the further out you plan, the more intentional you are today. So my verse for that is James 1:2-3, but I can give you these slides if you want them. You don't have to. But, you know, it says, when our pain and our troubles of any kind come your way, consider it as an opportunity for great joy. For you know that when your faith is tested, your endurance increases, your creative purpose will be revealed to you, and you will be living a fulfilling life in Christ. Now, I know that's the LBR version. You can cross-check it for apostasy. So I don't know how well you can see this, but this is kind of a graph. I'm kind of a visual guy, but this is kind of a graph that I use. And I believe we find clarity in our life when we have a decision-making process. So in your homes, if you have a decision-making process that you and your wife agree upon, you probably have a good outcome. If you disagree on how you make a decision, trust me, chaos reigns. The interesting thing is this here is our years of our life, okay? So we have a choice. We have a choice to pursue clarity in our life so that we have a more fulfilling life, or we just live life the way it is and let life happen. This is our normal trajectory of our life. I was thinking that was a little blurred, maybe not. Okay, so first of all, you know, here in our 10 and 20 years old, we're dreaming, okay? And we have hopes, right? 20 and 30. Then we come and we start facing reality around 30 and 40. That's usually in our life when pain begins. That's when we start clipping Sears and Roebuck, you know, pictures of things that we want to do when we get older, right? Okay, so we, you know, him and I know what Sears and Roebuck catalog, right? Yeah, right. So, but then reality turns into disappointments. So you have this reality and disappointments tension here. The interesting thing is there's another alternative, and I like to call this the stewardship curve. And there's some business terms on here that might not make sense to you, but I think it starts out with understanding what you're taking ownership of your life. That's the first. Until we take ownership, little changes in our life. When we take ownership, the next thing is to face the reality of where we are. And there's a little tool we use in business, and I strongly encourage you to use it in church too. But it's a little tool where you list all your strengths. So DaySpring has strengths. Did you know that? That's your brand. There's things that DaySpring does really well. Okay? And for you to identify those as a group is a very healthy thing. There's also some things you don't do well. All right? And you need, and the interesting thing is, especially in business and in personal life, is your weaknesses, you can keep on improving your weaknesses, but it's much better to focus on stewarding your strengths and asking for help for other things. Let's say a marriage counseling, you have a lot of hurting marriages in your church and you don't have the bandwidth to mentor all those marriages, it's good for you to reach outside of your church and ask for other people to help you. There's nothing wrong with that. And I think that's an area we could probably do better at. We have this thing where we, yeah. Then, you know, you got to get really clear on where you want to be. There's actually a methodology in this. Until you have established your values as a congregation, by the way, your values are already affecting your culture. But until you identify those values and say, these are our non-negotiables, we will filter every decision in this church based on these 3 to 4 values. Until that happens, you don't have a clear baseline. So one of those values would be, we are unapologetically Anabaptist. Are you, aren't you? Okay. If you're not, define the worldview that this church is going to be governed by. Okay? Because that is so foundational. That's the filter for every decision you need to make. But this has caused a tremendous amount of tension, bad tension, in our churches, especially with the charity movement. And the interesting thing about the charity movement was their focus on evangelism. Now, this is something that's very interesting that I would like you to think about. And it's just my perspective. In fact, I should have made that disclaimer at the beginning. Everything you're hearing from me is London's perspective. So just eat watermelon and spit out the seeds. So my perspective is the reason why charity had the trajectory it did is because of its focus. And the focus is the conservative Anabaptists were their enemies. And they spiritualized stuff that wasn't even spiritual, okay? I don't know if you guys homeschool here, and I don't care if you do, and I think it's a good thing in most cases, in a lot of cases. We didn't, and we had a good experience with school. We had a great school, but it's not a spiritual thing. If you want to spiritualize homeschool, it's going to bite you someday because it's not spiritual. So one thing a charity did in a negative, they spiritualized things that weren't spiritual, and then they had an ideology called Christian Home Series, Godly Home Series, which we don't want to talk about that right now. But that created a influx of people and that were following an ideology instead of a lifestyle. that bit them. So we can either learn from these things or we can ignore them and repeat them. And the thing that's interesting to me is you can measure the success of every generation by its ability not to react to the inconsistencies of the generation before it, but to build on those inconsistencies for a better generation. The interesting thing, when you react to the inconsistencies of a generation the generation before you, all you'll do is just repackage the very same thing. It's the very same thing. It's just repackaged. We justify it because we repackage it, but it's the very same thing. So I would rather my children know my inconsistencies and tell them about it and say, you guys got to come up with a better way, and help them with that instead of trying to ignore my inconsistencies and they repackage them. So that would be one encouragement. Just get really real about what your inconsistencies are here, okay? After you get your values clear and what's going to anchor the church, the next thing you got to do is decide where you're going. So I'm going to talk about Freeman a little bit here because I think he's okay with it. But the role of a leader, there's three roles of a leader. It's to cast the vision for the church. It's to guard the gate of the culture of the church. So it's his job to guard the gate. If crazy comes in the church, he has to bring him to a decision and decide, say, listen, this is crazy here. We have to decide whether you want to continue to be crazy or if you want to go somewhere where there's a crazy church. Nah, that's not a nice way of saying it. But the point is you need to come, people need to be brought to a decision. I think the people that you love the most, you bring to a decision. Do you know what I mean by that? If you truly love someone, you're going to bring them to a decision. And it's not always fun. And you know this because you have children. But because you love your children so much, you bring them to a decision. And it costs you something. So that's one of the questions as I've been asking you is, what are you willing to pay for the trajectory of your children? What are the things you're willing to give up? After you have your vision clear, then you can come down and have your mission, which your mission is how you're going to get there. And the job of the leader is to make that really clear. This is how we are going to get this. This is the only way that this is the path forward to reach our vision. That's your mission. So I know people think that really gets squishy, but it anchors every organization, and you can call it whatever you want. But at the end of the day, your values are your baseline, your non-negotiables. Your vision is where you're going, and your mission is how you're going to get there. And if you don't define that and make it clear and write it on the wall and put it right on top of that door as you leave every Sunday so you know that you're going out into the world and you're going to deliver on that vision, you're not going to be in Revelations as a good church. All of us want to be a hero. All of us want to be in a Hebrews 11. All of us want to be the good church, the good two churches in Revelation. But how many of us want to pay the price? It costs. Anything of any value in this world costs you something. In fact, the longer it goes, the more dearly we're going to have to pay for it. Because we live in a twisted, dark, miserable world. We have reached a tipping point in our economy. I don't know if you know this or not, but probably do. But we have more millennials than we do. Look at our government. Look at the old geezers in the government right now. What are they going to be replaced with? The rioters in Oregon, or where are you going to get them? Okay. Well, it starts with Hollywood because they have the most money. So get excited about that a while. So if you have values, vision, mission, Now you have to have goals. And that's why I was telling you, just one thing this year, guys. Just one thing. That's all I want to hear you do. Just one thing. Because I come back next year. If I'd come back next year at this time and you did one thing, think about the percentage more, the impact it would have if every single one of you would just commit to one thing to improve the spiritual health of this church. If we take that course, it goes on a trajectory of acceleration. That is the point of acceleration. When we define that, when we have that level of definition in our churches, in our homes, in our personal life, at that point, things accelerate. And I'll tell you a story. It's a story in the Bible about the guys that got the three bags, right? Remember at the end, God's goal, those are two targets up there. The first target is where God wants you to be at the end of your life. If you continue on this trajectory, it turns into failures and regrets and denial and sin, and then you get to be a cynical old man. Can I tell you one thing? Stay away from cynical old men. They've gotten to the end of their life and they don't have the answers. That's why they're cynical. Ignore them. Avoid them. They're old men that got the end of life and don't have answers. That's why I hang out with three old men that did have the answers. Because I see it in their families. I see it in the fruits of their labor. That is what I call the regret gap. That's when we have a regret between where God wanted us to be, that's our purpose, the purpose He had for our life, and where we fell short. Well, my Bible says that God looked at that man and He said, "To hell with you. Give your money to that guy." And if you don't think He said that, you read the verse. He said, "Throw this man out where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth." Amen. It's a serious thing. I think we don't take our purpose, God's purpose for our life, serious enough. And I think, but it's when we steward our pain and the people and the presence of our life, the time, our talents, and our treasures, that God shows up in ways we never thought possible. I feel extremely unworthy for the life I have. Extremely unworthy. I don't know. I like graphs and stuff. So, you know, in the age of 10, 0 to 10, it's all about security. 11 and 19, it's all about self. Okay, that's the challenging time of life. 20, it's about survival. It's kind of moved a little bit. That's kind of like when you get married and you got to make a living. And then 30s, you start kicking in your success if you put in the effort. But 40s is when you start struggling with significance. Now, what might be interesting to you is the people I coach are between 35 and 55. After 55, I don't know, I don't have the frame of mind to deal with it after 55. But usually that's when men start feeling enough pain in their life they're willing to change. You see, I can't coach anybody that their identity is what they do. If what you do is your identity, it will consume you. And it could steal the hearts of your children. But at that point in life, you have a choice. You either buy a Harley or you do something else. And in your 50s, you start getting your stride because we'll explain this later. Then in the 60s, you start being more strategic about your life. And that's why I'm talking to you about Freeman. You have a choice. You can either preserve the guy or you can burn him up. You need to start thinking about your succession in your 70s. You know, what are you going to leave with to your children? Are you going to leave a bunch of wealth or are you going to leave wisdom? And then 80s, it gets kind of slippery, and then you sleep a lot when you're 90, and then you get silent at 100. My grandma went to 102, but She was just... So here's my thought. Everything in life's a cycle. And so I see it at zero we start, right? We're born and we die at zero. So do you notice that the gap between 10, 20, 30, and 40 is bigger than on the other side? This is what I can tell you. An old man told me once, he said, every decade doubles in speed. He said, after 40, Lyndon, every decade doubles in speed. He was so right. Right, Freeman? Oh, man, it was yesterday. Unbelievable. So this is, you have a choice. When you hit there, that's why I call true north, when you hit there, you have a choice. At that point, you have a choice. You can either buy a Harley or you can reflect on your life and think about how God has blessed you and saved you and how you're going to give that back to the next generation or you're going to lose it.
Which one do you recommend?
Yeah, well, yeah. No, I don't really recommend the Harley, honestly, but I was came short of that because of the area. You know, you guys down here, I don't know. So anyway, I think if you reflect back, I don't know how well you can see this, you either reflect or react. If you react, you get the Harley. If you reflect, you invest in the next generation. And if you're going to reflect back and make a plan forward, I'm going to tell you, if you plan, you prosper. It's your choice, all right? But this, I'm going to tell you, when you hit that 40 to 50 range and you don't have a vision for the rest of your life, you don't have a plan for the rest of your life, you don't know what your values are. I had an uncle, he always said, if a man don't get his life together with Christ at 40, it's an awful hard job afterwards. And I, you know what? I've seen there's so much truth in that. I love this. I'm a big one-liner. But Mark Twain said, the two most important days of your life is when you're born and when you found out why. It's kind of scary. Have you guys figured that out yet? Okay, that's what I call purpose. All right. But this is something I know. When you know where you're going, so will everybody else. Okay? And when you make a declaration in your family and you're willing to put that on the wall, write it, put it on the wall, your children will take notice. If you'd ask one of my children how I'll die a successful man, this is what they'll tell you. I'll die a successful man if my children can look in the eyes of every human being and see Jesus Christ. And because of that, my daughter invited a guy with a clock, is that what they call them? Or what do you call them? Guns?
Lock.
Lock, huh?
Lock.
Yeah, he had a clock pistol in his shoe. And he's like 7 feet tall. He had his shirt buttons open halfway down his chest. She said, Dad, can I invite him to our wedding? Because he was a family friend, right? And you know what? He gave him $500 when he left. And he told me, he said, I never experienced anything like that in my life. Tears run down his eyes. Please, guys, do not look past that stuff. It's all a facade. There's a little boy in every man. Now, don't take advantage of them, wives. But anyway, there's a little boy in every man. I can't stress this enough. When we put declarations on the wall, I think God shows up. You know, there's a lot of scripture that I could take you to that man made declarations, wrote them on the wall. It goes all the way back to piles of stone. Every time they passed that pile of stone, you told a story. We lost our story. That's what Willie's talking about. We've lost our story. We're not telling our story. When you start reading our story, people gave their life for what people just throw away on a whim. We have stuff, we have been gifted things that we have no clue the price that was paid for it. And that applies to our country too, for that matter. This is one of my favorite Bible verses, Habakkuk 2, 2, and 3. It says, write it on the wall. Write it in a way that you will attract those that are running so that they will run with you. Again, that's the LBR version. You read it for yourself. That verse has really transformed my life, and I started writing things on the wall. the genius was Martin Luther. Now, this guy was genius. He not only wrote it on the wall, he nailed that booger to the door of God's house. Now, all I can tell you is everything you do communicates. In fact, what you do screams in compared to what you say. So just remember that. Your children are watching you. I really don't care. What's interesting about this generation is, I love this generation, by the way. You are the best generation. All right? The 40 and down. I believe in you guys. You guys are awesome. And I'll tell you why. For several reasons. Number one is you have unprecedented opportunity. Unprecedented. My child went to China twice now. $600. Come on. That's unbelievable. You guys are a backpack show me generation. You literally have backpacks. I mean, you have enough stuff in there to survive in that bathroom for 3 weeks. You have your bag packs and you're ready to go. It's actually a symbol of something. You guys are mentalists. You can leave on a minute's notice. You don't have the baggage that we did. We were all about assets. Okay? The other thing is you're a show me generation. Okay? You don't really care what we say anymore because you can get that on Google because you think Google's divinely inspired. You just want us to show you by our lives that we know what sacrificial living is. I mean, it's such a contradiction. Willie was talking about this, but we talk about sacrificial living. How can you live sacrificially in America? How do you do that? One cheeseburger a week? I'd go Chick-fil-A, but... Anyway, Martin Luther King is one of my heroes for that reason only. No, he was good. So the stuff. Freeman said you guys love movies here. I want to recommend a movie. I'm not a big movie guy, but I want to recommend this movie. This is my favorite movie to illustrate this point. But it was Eric Little. Did anybody ever watch this movie, by the way? Okay. It says, I believe God made me for a purpose, but he also made me fast, and when I run, I feel his pleasure. We all want to feel God's pleasure. And when you are on a journey to discover your purpose in life, your created purpose, why God created you, you will feel his pleasure. This I can promise you. In that movie, what's interesting to me, I recommend that movie to people that are starting to do this thing where they are minimizing Sunday as being a day of rest type of thing. That guy actually gave up his... Yeah, he was willing to give up his thing because he would not run on Sunday, and he turned the carts to the king. It's an unbelievable story. All right, I told you about it, and here I go to 10-year plan. Usually when I say a 10-year plan, people glaze over, but I think that's the job of a leader. The job of a leader has to create a 10-year plan, or some people say 5, that's okay, but I'm going to tell you, stretch it just a little further. Because 10 years is a generation, so there's something magical about 10 and 20. So why do you think that 20 is impactful? Anybody think about that? How old are you? Well, I'm glad you're still in the temple, but are you still a leader?
I'm still a leader.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, good. Sounds like you're kind of broken and humble both. So, do you know the age of a man in the temple? What are you doing?
A man in the temple.
Are you like a tired man in the temple?
That's yours.
So what was the man in the temple? What was his job that was over 50? Well, I'm trying to see if you know your Bible, but well, Numbers 4. Go count how many times it says the man age of a man in the temple. I think you'll find it's around 15 times. The age of a man in the temple is 25 to 50. But what was the job of the 50-year-old man? he was to get behind the 25-year-old. He never left the temple. So the good news is, lock him down. Okay? Don't let him leave the temple, but change his job title. The point is every generation must die for the next to live. We have to get out of the way. We have no choice. If we don't get out of the way, you will not own this church. Our age group has to step back so the next generation owns the outcome of the church. And it's you guys. It's you guys that are 40 and under. You guys are the leaders of this church. Whether you are officially or you're not, you're still leading the church. Suck it up, Buttercup. Because that tipping point I'm telling you about, it's about influence. Right now, from 40 and under, is starting to take over the influence of the church, and you will actually set the trajectory of the future of this church, not Freeman. Freeman's done in a lot of ways. The only opportunity he has at this point, I didn't tell him this, I don't think, but in my mind, the only opportunity he has at this point is to get behind you 40 years old. If you guys don't want to go there and you don't want to hear from him, that's fine. That's fine. Then don't blame him if you wind up in the swamp. And I'm not talking about playing shuffleboard in Florida. I know that's a swamp. But what I want to tell you about that is there's three different kinds of categories of things we do when we plan. One is a commitment. So that's why I ask you just to make one commitment, one thing that you will not compromise. You're guaranteed to do. Because I know that, anybody ever hear of atomic habits? No. Anybody remember that little jingle you used to sing in Sunday school, each victory will help you another to win? There is a tremendous amount of truth in that. Because each victory, you build on each victory and you'll win more, right? Well, the same thing happens backwards too. Every loss will, but we have to win. So as Dayspring, pick one thing you're going to win in 2024. I don't care what it is, just win. Because people don't like to lose. And if you don't have some, and if you do it, have a barbecue and invite everybody. And say, you know what, we're just celebrating this win. Okay, do something. That's another thing we don't do well. We don't celebrate well. We don't think it's spiritual. But my Bible says they celebrate it all the time and they brought the house down doing it. Okay? But you need something collectively that you can work together and win on. It has to take all of you guys working together. Because if you don't, it's not the ownership of the whole church to do it. And you celebrate when everybody wins together. That's by the way, the way you decide whether you're a team or not. If you're a team, you win together. If you're a dysfunctional church, you all go your own way and are self-governed. So the first thing is commitments, things that non-negotiables you're going to do to make it happen. The next thing is opportunities. So every year renders different opportunities based on circumstances. And then you throw in some experiments. You don't know if it's going to work or not. Just try it. And it's okay if it don't. Say, you know what, that one didn't work. Let's try it a different way. And you got to do a few of those. So I personally think that's... Sorry, I'm getting into some business stuff here, but another thing that is important is if you do something well, so you're in Hebrews. So this is my acceleration recipe, and this is what makes healthy churches in my mind. When you have uncompromising values, you guys have to agree on things you're not going to compromise. That's the only way. That's the only foundational way. You can't build on something that's something you're going to compromise or something you're all going to interpret, make your own interpretation. I find that a lot in churches. People, they don't really mean that. They're not, Well, keep on coming back to it. If you need to always be every brother's meeting, maybe what you want to do is have someone repeat a value that you have and the definition of what that value is today, Spring. Because, see, you can have as many definitions as you have. Okay, so one of my values is radical generosity. Well, that keeps me in mind all the time, how am I being generous, right? So I keep asking myself, how can I be generous, okay? So I try to live that out. Yours might be something else, but I have a definition for that, okay? But it could be a different definition for everybody in the room. So the biggest problem a lot of times is that we have these goals and dreams and stuff, but we don't define what that means for the whole congregation. Now, you can individually have an interpretation, but the whole congregation needs to understand and be definition. One thing I will tell you, though, as soon as leaders bring definition, people leave. So get ready. As soon as your leaders make definition, people are going to leave here. Just happens. Just happened in our church. As soon as I draw a line in the sand, people leave. Because there's a certain element of people in a church that don't want authority. So I just say prepare yourself. You've got to have a compelling vision. People are drawn to a vision. So see, you may have been drawn to Dayspring's vision, but you weren't drawn by how they're going to get there. And that's an interesting dynamic, and we don't have time to talk about that. The next one is vision, mission clarity. So not only how you're going to get there, but what that means. Okay? I coached two different models, and you might think that this is a little funny, but one of my models is I coach team to the SEALs, the SEAL teams. How many of you guys ever read stories about the SEAL team? If you guys like good movies, go to TED Talk on extreme ownership, all right? And then think about how that might trigger you, the commitment you're going to make this year. You know what the tagline is for SEALs? No man left behind. You know what that means? I'll drag your dead body out across the battlefield. No man left behind. And they'll drag your dead body out across fire. SEAL teams have it going on. I mean, well, then you know my illustration, right? If you had that kind of loyalty in this church, you go through a block wall. SEAL teams go through block walls. They do humanly impossible stuff. My Bible uses military, so I can too. If you want, I'll give you a list of SEAL team reasons why SEAL team is the most unbelievable team model out there. It should be the child of God's, because our centrality is in Christ, not a common enemy, earthly enemy. We serve a supernatural, and it's just a shame. I coached to customer service in Chick-fil-A, and I'm bringing you back to the mission clarity. So, what do you think Chick-fil-A sells? Okay, chicken sandwiches. Anything else? Getting warm. Cows. Customer service. 83% of their training is in customer service. The rest is chicken. They got chicken down. That's not the hard part. I'm not sure if you know how to serve our people. Their tagline this year is the hospitality leader in the fast food industry. When did you ever hear hospitality and fast food in the same sentence? That's what I want to know. I interviewed three different managers in Chick-fil-A. And it's just, do it sometime. It's interesting. They'll talk to you. Number four is one that I think that's, it can be hard, but I think it's something you need to consider. And that is every year you need to get really transparent about what your current reality is in an organization. Even in your marriage, if you should go out at least once a year and talk about what's the reality in your marriage and your family? Because that will help put your plan in place and know how you're tracking. It also allows you, the opportunity to celebrate. Another thing I got to tell you is you'll be surprised when you start writing things down and what you want to do. You'll actually surprise you how much you got done, and by being intentional and also talking about it and getting it done. They put a plan in place, role clarity. This sounds funny, but you know what? Maybe you need to make a job description for that guy. Get him out of here. repurposing. You know what I mean? Because he could do a lot more if you could take the stress out of it because of his age, right? Because the older we get, stress really takes a toll on our body, right? So you have a choice if you like the guy, that is. Okay, otherwise, yeah, crash and burn. But the point is you can preserve him and get a lot more out of him if you get strategic, okay, is what I'm saying. I can give you a few pointers if you want to. Then getting real clear on whose role is what. Now, if you're a member of this church, what's give me one thing that you would think is a role as a member of the church. Okay. How's that working out for you? So getting really clear, so like when I go into a board or something, one of the things I do is we write a job description for a board member on that board, because we find the board members sign up for something sometimes just for the name, just for the position. That's has no value. There's a cost for everything. So if you define the cost of the role, what does it mean to be a deacon at Dayspring? What's it mean to be a member at Dayspring? Oh my goodness. You wouldn't want to know that, would you? You wouldn't want to detail what a member, an ideal member, a hero at Dayspring looks like. Try that. We did that in business. We wrote out what a hero was in that position, right? Now, we told them that, you know, you came in at $18 an hour, you went out at $35, all right? But you didn't get $35 unless you're a hero, right? Because everybody wants to be in Hebrews 11. It creates a winning culture, and I already talked about that. We all need to win. If we keep losing, everybody gets tired, everybody gets worn out. Just win. Make a small win. What's the small win you can have this year? I don't know. But figure it out at your next brother's meeting. What would be a win for everybody? Just get a little pressure off, right? This is what I tell you, though. This is an interesting piece. Winning cultures attract committed members that contribute to the health of the church and deliver on the Great Commission. See, the only purpose that this church exists, or any church, is to deliver on the Great Commission. If you're not delivering on the Great Commission, you're not healthy. See, the Great Commission is outside the walls of this church. And if you're always focusing inside the walls of this church, you're not delivering on the Great Commission. All right. This is why I can guarantee you, and this is my testimony. If you dare to plan 10 years from today, you will reach your target goals 3 to 5 years before you plan. I'm saying if they're God's goals for your life. And my question is, are those goals aligned with His plan for your life? And so you have to discover your purpose to know that. Because I know if you do that, you're going to make God smile. So I'm going to leave you with these three questions and a story. How are you going to steward the present? What's going on in your life right now? The people in your life right now? And the pain that you've experienced to invest in those that you serve this year? What three declarations would you be willing to make as your family? It could be not to fry Freeman on the way home. What are the three decorations that you will make and nail to the wall in your house so that all your children can see for 2024? What will you do in 2024 to make God smile? My wife's heard this story so many times, but it's a story that really kind of anchors what I believe. There's a guy by the name of Chris DeMurdy tells a story. He says, we are all born for the valley. See, the valley has green grass and a nice, beautiful creek going down through it, like Freeman's house, you know. And it has great, beautiful, straight cornrows. And the women, you know, they sit together in the living room and they make quilts and have babies. But one day, one of those babies heads off to the mountains. and all the women get together and they're quilting and they talk about how terrible this is. I even use quilts. How terrible it is that so, you know, so-and-so's baby went off the mountain. Meanwhile, he's climbing up the mountain. About halfway up, he gets up there and says, "Wow, look at the view." And he builds a little house and builds a little fence, starts raising chickens. Krista Murdy said, "Burn down the house, tear down the fence, kill the chickens, and keep climbing. Because life is about infinite climbing. And we'll be climbing for the rest of our life. But when we get to the top, I want to meet you there. Because life is about infinite climbing. It's always going to be hard if you want a reward. So just keep on climbing." All right. I don't know. I think we were going to eat at 6. Do we want a Q&A? Where's Willie? Do you have any questions for Willie and I? The reason for this Q&A was my purpose for it was, you know, they say the question's always the answer. Unless you answer, you're not going to own it. So the best answer is your answer. But you're welcome to ask these questions. Yeah.
I got a question that I was still wanted to ask, but
you don't want to ask it?
Huh?
You don't want to ask it?
I don't know if it's a good one to ask.
The best questions are the dumb ones. You like that?
Yeah, it was great. How you're using a lot of terms and throwing that in here and there, so like, can you just talk specifically about that and like what exactly you're saying?
No.
You made a lot of hints towards that, and you haven't really said what exactly.
All right, well, I'm going to stick my neck out a little bit here and answer your question. Yeah. So, did you know that there's people at different levels in this? In any audience, there's people at different levels of investment, like how much they're invested in here, how vested they are. So, I'm going to use we'd always grade our employees. Okay, now this can be challenging. But an A player in the business is the guy that's making the most money, right? He supports, models, and defends the vision, mission, and values of the company. He's delivering that chicken sandwich like no one else, right? So he's an A player, okay? Now you have B players. Now, the interesting thing of a B player is he's like this, all right? There's the A's, there's your C's, here's your B. He's not totally converted yet. He might have only been here for 6 months and really doesn't know what's going on here, right? He's trying to figure it out. The interesting thing about the B player is he can be evangelized by the A player. So if you're an A player, are you an A player? If you're an A player, if you're an A player, Freeman can tap you on the shoulder and say, "Hey, help me. I need this guy. We gotta get him on our team, evangelizing, mentoring, right?" Then you have the C player. So the A player is the contributor. The B player is risky. Is risky. He's still risk. He's still a risk to the organization because you don't know which way he's going, right? Then you have a C player, and he's a drainer. Now, don't raise your hand if you're a drainer. But if you're a drainer, you're taking more than you're there taking, but you're not giving. You're not contributing to the vision, mission, and values of the organization. some business every year we do that, and then we, of course, if based on where you are in the business, but the manager had to submit a plan of how he was going to coach that C person up or out. People are people everywhere you go. The people that are C players, and you know who you are. I have no clue. But the C players in this room need to be either coached into this church or out of this church, because they need to be dismissed to succeed elsewhere, because this church doesn't have the bandwidth. Or they don't have the tools to bring them on board, so they need to go somewhere where they're valued and they can live out what they want, because obviously they're not bought into the vision, mission, and values, right? But if you don't have vision, mission, and values clarified for the church, you don't have no baseline to lead or have a good, meaningful conversation, right? So that was a long way to answer your question, but the point is if you want to burn a leader out, you can only sustain so many C's. Did you know that in the organization? Do you know how many you can? What percentage? Guess. 20%. If you have more than 20% drainers in your organization, you'll lose A's. The only way to keep A's is coach your C's up or out. I'm going to emphasize out, because if you leave them there, you'll lose your A's. And a church cannot thrive if it has too many C's. It will die. And we do not have these conversations. But he has to define who the A, B's, and C's are. So I'd call him up sometime and tell him to give you the definition. But that's the reason why leaders burn out. Leaders burn out because they have too many C's. Because you can't expect the A to evangelize the C. You follow what I mean? And maybe that sounds too mechanical, and I apologize if it does. Try to spiritualize that. Yeah.
Why can they? Leader's supposed to evangelize or move on to see.
Because he left him in the door.
What?
You left him in the door. You should have met him at the door and told him what an A was. He's a C. He's a C because you did not spend the time with him before he got in here. And now he's a liability. And it's your job to guard the gate of this fold.
So for a lot of people, you've got to take care of.
Yeah. Sorry. Jesus used the whip. I don't know. Get creative.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. That didn't work.
That's okay.
Sorry. Yeah. That
yes, sir.
Okay, so my wife says I get up way too stern, and, you know, so if I look like I'm really stern, just smile at me. I'll reciprocate. I get too intense. I apologize.
He's just doing a hit and run.
Yeah, you can. Actually, it's very easy to know. You know how it is? How do you think? How do you know if a C has A potential? Because usually a C is wounded, maybe. And the question is, can he let that woundedness at the door?
All this stuff is new, but you're going to have to build in on
it. Wouldn't a C be coming to the A's and the leader and asking how to grow?
Yeah. How to contribute. How can I do to contribute to the health of this church? Mm-hmm. Why do you think I'm asking you to figure out one thing you can do to contribute to the health of the church? Because if you're not contributing, you're risk. So, but if you don't know what, or if you're not have a clear understanding, if that fellow coming in doesn't have a clear understanding where this church is going, you're not being fair to him if you don't take the time to explain, this is where we're going, this is how we're getting this, and these are our non-negotiables. If you don't have the non-negotiables, you're toast, okay? You're evangelical. All right, so just.
But that is one reason why it's good to have this written down. That's why it's important. I appreciate what we went through when we entered where we are today. This is the covenant. This is what is expected. It's not guidelines. It's not beating you up. But in a short time, I understood where this church was going. and it was clarified, and it was not the pressure on the leader to do that, but it was done within the brotherhood, and it was a blessing. That's why it's important to write.
Yeah. Sorry.
You got some good A's here.
Yeah, just be observant. The guy that's always negative and always being, you know, shooting everything down, just say, that's a great idea. What's your solution? If you don't have a solution, your solution is better than his. Otherwise, it's criticism, right?
Sometimes it's hard to tell. I mean, how do you know that person might come through, or he might be such a detriment that, I don't know, you know, I guess some of the mercy in me, like, you know, here's this person trying to plug in somewhere, and I'm going to tell him, well, you're A, B, or C now. If you're
No. Let him decide that, okay?
But you could ask
him. You can make the definition, but he has to decide who he is.
Then you could also ask him, how best can we help you find, how can we best help you find where you can flourish and where you can grow?
You can weaponize this. Yeah. You know what I mean? You can weaponize this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Be careful. It's kind of like, it's kind of like doing the DISC process or assessments and all that kind of stuff. That can be used in a good way, or it can be weaponized. Oh, I'm just a D. That's weaponizing it. Mm-hmm. Well, you're a C. That's not the point. Great question. That's his job. So you can, I can give you, I'm a visual guy. Oh, yeah. So she said, when they come in the door, are they B's or C's or A's or whatever? They really need to find that out as a leader. They need to have that level of discernment to say, listen, I'm not sure if you're going to make it here. And they need to be honest. Leadership is, part of leadership is being honest with their people and say, you know what? If they don't want to know what your assessment is, okay, so if I'm, okay, and I guess, I keep going back to business, but when I hire somebody, I would go through a 90 days where I would ask them to read books, real little books, usually allegories, and then we'd have a conversation because I want to give them a language. You know, here at Dayspring, you have a language. There's things you guys can talk about outside of this room that nobody else understands what you're talking about. That's precious, by the way. That's very precious. That's community. We had certain words in our business that nobody knew what it was talking about. All right. There's also words that everybody should know what to talk about. If you get served at Chick-fil-A, what do they say when they give you your sandwich? My pleasure. That's part of the brand. What's your brand? You know, when somebody called to our business, we always answer the phone. My name is Lyndon. How can I serve you? They didn't care if I was Lyndon Risser with three cats. They could have cared less. It was all about them. My name is Lyndon, so you know who I am. How can I serve you? Because our brand was service. Your service, we guaranteed your service in 15 minutes or it was free. We would call you back in 15 minutes or it was free. Were we serious about our service? What are you serious about? It's your brand. So decide what you're serious about and what you'll pay a price for. It will be your brand. Everybody will know you by it. Okay. Everybody knows Chick-fil-A doesn't sell cows, but anyway, use a little humor with it too. Back to your answer. It actually is an extremely good question. And the thing about it is, does the leadership have the time to determine where that person is on that scale and then put the plan in place, say, well, listen, so Dean Taylor, this was an interesting source. Dean Taylor told us when we went to Living Hope, he said, Lyndon, you know what? We don't offer membership in the first year. Because of the type of church we are, we don't think it's healthy to give you membership the first year. What we do ask you to do, by the way, if you don't want membership in the first year, you've got to make a decision too, okay? Because you don't want just people parking. And the last place you want them to park is in the back bench. Because, you know, if they just want to sit back there and do nothing, they're not a contributor. I'm just kidding, okay? My wife likes to sit on the back bench too. Okay, but if you need to find out where they are on their journey so you can come alongside of them and be a good steward. And but if they don't want that, then it's why are they here? If they don't want to be confronted about things that aren't in alignment with your culture, why are they picking this culture? Everybody here is here because of choice. If it's not your choice to be here, why are you here? This is a voluntary organization. That just really messes with me when I think about people complaining and griping and all this kind of stuff and going against the ministry. Like, why are you here? You don't have to be here. Get out of here. There's so many churches around. Especially, come to Lancaster, man. I'll give you, it's like a smorgasbord. It's a swamp of all swamps.
Lancaster needs to, Jesus. Lancaster needs Jesus. Come to Lancaster.
Did I answer your question? Go ahead.
I don't have a good answer. Yeah. Maybe they feel they're called to do that. I don't know.
They don't want to be seen as the person who made a bad choice.
Yeah.
Score! You know, that's funny in business. I'll just say this a little bit. That's funny in business. If you have a good culture in business, people self-select. Your mark?
Oh, they don't want to be seen as the person that made a bad choice.
They don't want to be viewed as a... They don't want to view, and this is so true in business. And people that come to your business came there because they thought they were the ideal person for the job. And they also, if you had a good job description, good role clarity. The other reason why they came is because that was the best choice they had, right? So they were already, everybody comes into the organization here and they immediately move one way or the other. They either move toward euphoric or cynicism. And if I were Euphrium, I'd put a chart in the back of the church and have everybody, there's all kinds of increments, right? But I'd put it, every year I'd do a reality check. Where are you on that scale? You know, because there's a scale, right? Because it's a reality of what you have to work with, right? You know, and if your people are all on that negative side and you don't have enough, that's the ABC, right? You know? But what's interesting is you. I'm sorry. But back to your question is people want to be viewed as making a good decision. So if they come to an organization and they are not a fit, well, then they want the organization to take the blame as being the one that made, you know, is in the wrong, not them. So that's a good.
Maybe the other thing is, just, you know, my experience is so many people might want to, they might know what they don't want, but then I ask them, what do they want? Or do they figure out what they believe, and they're sitting in a church because they don't really know what they want, and yet they are willing to see all the negative. I don't know.
We're past 6 o'clock. Are we going to eat at 6? Are we going to eat at 6?
Okay.
Do you have anything more to say on that?
I have a little, yep. A little exercise. If we want to wrap up the day, I guess I think I'll try this. So I know you're all getting a cognitive overload. There's a lot to think about, and so we'll try to be. It depends on you all tonight. going through today, you have a lot to think about, but let's try to bring wrap up the day here in one sense. This is an empty jar. Obviously, you can see that. This is like day spring, okay? I have a question for you, and think about the values. So what values, what non-negotiables would you like to see at Day Spring?
You want to just hold on?
What are the non-negotiables that you like to see at Day Spring?
Okay, one more.
Is the jar full?
I can't put any more balls in here, can I?
No,
I can't.
But there's also the other decision you have to make is this jar is full of all the things that are not known non-negotiable. And if you have all things that are fluid, you understand what I mean, you can't put anything in here. The jar is full. But when you begin with your values, all the other negotiable things flow around your non-negotiables. What are you all thinking? What does that lock you into? So we're just a few minutes behind.
So we'll just put it like this today. We'll just leave it here. Just want you to think about this. This is what you're working for. We can put it in spiritual terms. That's what we'll be talking about.
At least help your current plan put this in that safe direction.
Yeah. That's right. And this is structure. This is more, the practical side of all of that's driving you. And I think these are the things that I think Lyndon was saying. This is what you need to talk about. This is what you need to focus on that wraps up what he was talking about today. This is what begins. So I try to get you to verbalize. And you start verbalizing this to each other. And God, you can be the church that God intends a church to be. All right. Should I pray? Okay, let's pray. Father, we just thank you for this day. We thank you for your Spirit to guide us today and for what was spoken here. Lord, may this go deep, O God. May this go and change and the direction and the focus of the church, and may it become a healthy church and a godly church in this community. Father, we thank you for the food. We thank you for those that are sharing liberally with each other today, and we ask your blessing upon it. And I ask you would guide our conversation and our hearts. In Jesus' name, amen.